Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 154 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Hannah Flint.
I'm Clarice Lockery.
And I'm Amon Woman.
This week, Amon chats to star Jack O'Connell as we go back to black with Sam Taylor Johnson's Amy Winehouse biopic. Meanwhile, we batten down the hatches for Alex Garland's Civil War and ring the bell for the Oscar-nominated The Teacher's Lounge. Plus, in our hot take, what should celebrities do when their co-star is abused online? But first, let's catch up with the crew. I'm currently looking at Invincible from the Prime series, Invincible.
I had these sunglasses before I watched that show because I thought they made me look like an alien. Like, beep, boop, beep, boop.
They are quite bug-like.
Yeah, bug-like.
Or, you it's know, actually quite The Matrix.
The
it's
Matrix.
It's quite
Beyonce
cyberpunk.
On the Renaissance tour where she had those like bumblebee headpiece.
It's giving hackers.
It is giving hackers. That's kind of what I want. So
yeah,
and I'm just wearing it because we are recording at 6 p.m. and it's sunset in my eyes right now.
But that's good. Well, great. Isn't it great that it's like 6 and it's not like dark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Summer, baby! It's coming.
The solstice.
How you doing, Amon?
Well, I have to say, Hannah, before we continue, I know that you'll appreciate this especially. Khalees, maybe not so much, but Khalees, just go with us there. I think me and Hannah, we need to observe a moment of silence.
Excuse me. I am in all black. I am in mourning. I've even got black Crocs on.
Before we continue, I should say, if you have not watched X-Men 97, especially this week's episode of X-Men 97, we've got some spoilers coming in the next few seconds, so just skip ahead. But if you have watched it, then you know of what we speak.
Who died?
We're pouring one out for two X-Men. One...
20? How many people died? It was a massacre.
It was a massacre, but there's two deaths in particular that have me going, what? First, Magneto died, which was surprising.
What?
Yes. And then, Remy LeBeau, Gambit himself, perished at the hands of this evil-ass Sentinel, but not before going out like an absolute G.
Oh my God. It was insane.
I was not remotely ready for that at 9 a.m. that morning.
So I watched it, and then I'm in a very vulnerable time right now. I'm experiencing a lot of burnout. I come on my period. I'm doing all these things, and I watch that episode, and I'm like, why are you doing this to me, X-Men 97? I bawled my eyes out. And then... last night, I made my boyfriend watch it with me because I was like, and I had to kind of explain a little bit about, because he knows a little bit about Wolverine, but he doesn't really know. I did send him away with my Generation X graphic novel and Old Man Logan. You'll love him. I had to kind of explain it, and I just, like, this is actually, like, I'm not even kidding, Clarice. It's one of the greatest episodes of TV I've actually seen.
Yep.
It's just, and this is what I want. You know what I love about X-Men 97? I feel like I can talk about it now, like episode 5. I'm so sorry that this is going to be like a whole resume. Like, we normally kind of keep it going, but I feel like this is a really good topic. But there is something that I feel, you know, about what this series is doing. Not only is it kind of has this homage to the original animated series that has this earnestness, this sincerity, that it doesn't try and mock what it's based on, which is very much as I really enjoy the MCU, it takes the piss a lot about the source material, the names, the costumes, whatever, you know, whereas this, it's like, you can tell this series is made by like a gay man, a black gay man. I don't know if he's African, but a man of color who is gay, because it's so slutty. These slutty mutants, I love them. It's so camp. There's so much drama.
Yep.
Like, there's like a love triangle between Jean Grey and her clone, and Cyclops. They've had a kid. Then there's like a love triangle between Magneto, Rogue, and Gambit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so intense and just utterly romantic in so many ways. And then halfway through the episode, it's just like pure devastation.
Yeah.
It's just like, and just the way it's shot, and it's clearly like the anime influences coming in there very much in the way it looks. It's, yeah, it's just because there's something about the, you know, the animation of the 90s, very static. You know, there wasn't much moving, but here you can see, like, you know, there's close up on eyes and the eye shapes. Like, just a shift in an eyebrow raising just, like, tells me so much about what characters are. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I was just blown away by it. So, what the fuck did Bo DeMeo do to be sacked? Or, you know, what happened there? Because so far, Weeds Darn is in sensational storytelling.
Yeah.
And I only wish live action could actually just reach this kind of height.
Literally, I hope that they are taking all of the notes on what they're doing right now. And I tweeted this a few weeks ago, but between X-Men 97, Season 2 of Invincible, What If, the new Spider-Verse movies, like, the most consistent, high-quality level superhero storytelling is happening in animation right now, which is pretty awesome. And another indicator of why we should be better collectively as an industry of lifting this medium up rather than sort of making slight jokes about it at Oscar ceremonies, as has happened the last 2 years. Loving it. And so unpredictable. The fact that they're pulling the trigger on stuff like this and we're in episode 5 just has me thinking, what else are they going to do in this season?
I think you'll like it, Clarice. I think you should really get into it.
Yeah.
I'll come around eventually.
What I love about the episode, there is so much, it's too much. Mm. I love, sorry, just my final thing I was going to say about it, but I also love that the episode called Remember It.
Yeah.
And you think it's about this kind of idea about Jean Grey, who's like, doesn't understand her memories. She doesn't know. There's a really great scene. It's like, all of my memories say that I've loved you. It's like, do you love me or you just remember that you love me? Like, do you actually feel it or do you just remember it? And it's like, oh, it's that. And then later on, you're like, oh, no, that's what we remember. And also, there's a few Easter eggs in there for MCU fans, I would say, as well.
Yes, the final line, very reminiscent of Wanda.
It's exactly the same line.
Yeah. But also, remember is a callback to
persevering.
No, it's perspiring.
No, it's
no, that wasn't even Wanda, was it?
That
was
the robot. Vision. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I love how like so sassy you are about MCU. You loved WandaVision, didn't you?
I liked it until the end. I didn't like the final episode.
Yeah,
because you're like, you're a Zoomie-averse.
Zoomies.
Back into the Zoomies.
But yeah, the Remember It is also a callback to Gambit saying the same line in Season 2, way back when, of the classic X-Men series. So they're calling back to that as well. But yeah, all of which is to say that's all good. You mentioned love triangles there. We're not going to talk about it for a couple of weeks, but I have seen Challengers that... also a love triangle, or really it's a lust triangle if we're being more specific about it, but my goodness.
Spoilers!
I cannot wait to talk about that film, because spoilers, it is pretty good. Put it mildly. But yeah.
Well, I didn't watch X-Men 97, but I've got my cup of the show that I did watch this week.
Hey!
I don't know. I feel like maybe we might have a spoiler special coming out. This is coming out Sunday, so listening on Sunday, it's coming out tomorrow. Yeah. So make sure you're caught up on Fallout, because we have a spoiler special where I talked to everybody.
Everybody.
Not everybody. Dog Meat, though. I didn't talk to Dog Meat. I wish I'd talked to Dog Meat. I mean, he's not officially Dog Meat, but Dog Meat to me. but everybody else, yes.
Yeah. Very excited to listen to those interviews and to chat about the show with you.
And we're recording on a Friday night, Friday 12th. So the Cinema for Gaza auction ends in less than six hours. Have you been for anything? You've been for something.
Yeah. Well, this is weird because obviously when this goes out on Sunday, we'll know whether I want to. But we've got 6 hours for somebody to come in and and swoop. I mean, it would be great because, you know, this is the thing. I want someone to outbid me because I want someone to outbid me so much that I can't afford it anymore. But at the same time, it is for the Mr. Malcolm's List lot. For Mr. Malcolm's List, I'd like it to find out how to be a better woman.
Yeah, fingers crossed. But from last time I looked, we were like at 185K.
Amazing.
The Annie Lennox signed lyrics are at £20,000.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Hey, look, there's still 6 hours. Someone might bid $19,500 on me. Who knows? No one, who could say? No one can say. But thank you, every single person who's donated, who's bid, who's shared, who's, you know, again, like, Amon, thank you so much for putting some stuff in as well. Thank you, Greece, for sharing on your socials and bidding. Thank you, everyone, doing that. There is a little extra, well, some of something coming, though. It's already been launched, but we're doing a raffle. So if anyone who donates £10 and can send their proof of receipt to a specific our specific email, I'll put it in the show notes by Monday at noon, you're in with a chance to get like this massive package, a hamper. I mean, it's not technically a hamper. It's just like a metaphorical hamper. There's a Zoom with Lynn Ramsey. There's like special limited edition posters from You Were Never Really Here signed by Lynn, Joaquin Phoenix, and James Wilson, the producer. I think Layla's throwing in a book, signed book that she co-authored called The Screen Traveler's Guide. And Kayva Novak has also donated a signed picture from Four Lions, which is really cool. So that, and also, I think we can say we're also doing Cinema for Gaza t-shirts that you can actually buy and own. And proceeds going to charity. So I'll let you know when all that's out. Oh, exciting. And now this weekend I can sleep. But first.
Movies.
Let's review some movies.
You said that exactly like a YouTuber, and I can't say exactly right now.
What? Exactly like a YouTuber?
Yeah.
Which one?
No, just.
What, when I said but first?
But first. The pause, it was perfect. You have an extra career in the making if you want it.
I'll take it. But first, I'd like to go back to black.
I want people to hear my voice.
No, no, no.
And just forget their troubles for 5 minutes.
No, no, no.
Do you know what girl power means to me? Sarah Vaughan, Lauryn Hill. You need to know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
From primary school to sellout concerts.
It's going to happen one of these days. Voice like yours,
got to.
Well, it's one of the best I've ever heard.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
We only said goodbye with words. I died 100 times. You go back to her and I go back to black.
Man, really? I haven't listened to Amy Winehouse in a long time. Singer Amy Winehouse's tumultuous relationship with Blake Fielder Civil inspires her to write and record the groundbreaking album Back to Black. Directed by Sam Taylor Johnson from a screenplay by Matt Greenhall, it stars Marissa Abella, Jack O'Connell, Eddie Marzen, and Leslie Manville. So, Amon, you spoke to Jack O'Connell, who I love Jack O'Connell.
I like him too. It was really, really fun to chat with him. You know, he's a very, very talented actor. Always like seeing him on screen. This is another good performance from him in this film. It's funny. My favorite scene in the film, and we'll talk about it in just a second, involves Jack O'Connell and a rendition that he lives, or a scene involving the Shangri-Las and Jack O'Connell. And it's a meet cute between his character, Blake, and Amy. He did not know what the term meet cute means. So we had a good amount of fun with that, as me explaining to him what a meet cute actually is. But yeah, we talked about that. We talked about him meeting Blake and what he gleaned from that meeting that he put into his performance. And we talked about a bunch of other stuff as well. So here's that chat, me and Jack O'Connell.
Welcome to the Faith Fight Podcast, Jack O'Connell. How are you, sir?
I'm good, man. Yeah, you?
I'm good. Great to speak with you. We're here to talk about
Back to Black, in which you play Blake. When this opportunity landed on your desk, was it an immediate yes from you?
Kinda, yeah. I mean, slight trepidation. Wanted to know that everyone was going to approach it with the sort of best intentions, by which I mean, you know, not trying to snoop around, not trying to scratch around for scandal or whatnot. I wanted to know that it was going to be authentic and honest and a celebration. And that was pretty obvious straight away.
Yeah.
That's what Sam's intention was, and I thought the script was great. So, yeah. It was a yes, but I had to take a beat and just go, okay, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah. When you met with Blake, what did you glean from that meeting that you put into your performance?
I just thought he was sound.
Mm.
I think it's a good example of face value.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really have any assumption on someone until you've met them, until you've sat with them and spoke with them. I was very surprised. And then also found that any time we spoke about Amy, it was with complete sincerity.
Mm.
And so that informed what I was going to then do, like, massively.
Yeah. When you were talking about this role and thinking it through, as you say, before you said yes, what did you know about Amy's story before sort of you read the script? And now, having been on the other side of that, read the script, done the role, has there been anything that you learned about Amy that you didn't know previously?
I guess so. I mean, at the time, there's an awful lot out there.
Yeah.
Good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was kind of aware that she had a really intense time of it with regards to media coverage and the way paparazzi would treat her. Mm. It was life under a magnifying glass quite a lot. So there was that. Also, just that music is still amazing today.
Yeah.
it still will be in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then 20 years on from then, people will still be banging the tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a huge testament. That will speak more volumes, I think, than any press story or any tabloid story, you know. But it felt like her life was laid bare. And then what doing this film gave me the opportunity to do anyway was kind of take quite an in-depth look at the person involved there, the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we do detail in this is the effect that has on someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had an enormous talent and she was unwavering. She wasn't going to be moulded and packaged and parcelled into something that she wasn't. I'm just fascinated by that about her. So I think it just reinforced all of those things that I feel like I already respected about her.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I discovered about Blake was exciting to be involved in, and kind of bring another view, another take. This film is based on her lyrics,
yeah.
So we're telling this story via her songwriting to the best we can.
Yeah.
And that was cool, man. I thought that was a cool approach.
I like that. Marisa Abella is fantastic in this film. It's really, really stunning. Because I know you were cast first, when you had that initial meeting with her, did you immediately know that she was the one for this role? And if so, what was it about her that made you feel that way?
I was team Marisa from the get-go.
Mm.
There wasn't much persuasion needed, but I was there at the audition.
Mm.
It was her audition that really stuck with you. I just felt like she understood the energy
mm-hmm.
and the essence, which is a massive credit to her and her ability.
Mm-hmm.
And then no one, I don't think any of us, could have expected her to nail the vocals as well as she's done.
Yeah.
She'll tell you herself, there was never any requirement initially for her to sing. Mm. You know, people have got buttons for that these days. But she just nailed it.
Mm.
And so I remember the read-through, which was like one of the initial get-togethers, and parts in the script where she was required to sing, she just started belting out these Winehouse vocals. And it sounds cliche, but I'm telling you, the hairs on the back of the neck were up, and we were looking around at each other going, blimey, this could be special.
Yeah, no, you were right. Have you ever been on the flip side of that in terms of you walk into an audition room, a big name actor's already cast, and then you just click immediately? Have you ever been on the other side of that?
I guess so, man, but more and more these days, it's all like Zoom. So, like, I miss going in a room. It's quite rare these days. And so I'm not a great Zoom actor. Feels a bit like trying to act in a chat room, you know? But don't even get me started on that.
Yeah.
It's one of my bugbears at the moment.
Yeah, I think this, well, with the COVID and everything changed the game in terms of auditions, but what you're saying.
That's
a shame. I don't often hear that actors miss being in the audition room.
I love That's being in the room, man. I mean, it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can have some howlers. You know, but that was all part and parcel of it once. Just seems like a bygone era.
Yeah, that's a shame. My favourite scene in the movie is your meet cute with Amy. It's hilarious. It's funny. It's really, really well done.
What's that?
Your meet cute with Amy.
Meet cute.
So your first meeting when you meet her in the pub,
and
you sing that song and you learn the lyrics. I think the Shangri-Las.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that scene is fantastic. It's my favourite scene in the movie. What do you remember about filming that? And did you already know that song beforehand?
Yeah, I love that tune.
Oh,
love the Shangri-Las. I love that era.
Mm.
You know, like rock and roll music of that time. I'm a massive fan of. So when that day was approaching, I thought, look, I'm not going to do this by halves. So I was in front of my bathroom mirror. I was in the shower giving it some. I made sure I knew it word for word.
Yeah,
it's just a belting track, so you know that one was, it was inspired.
Yeah. I love that. Would you mind?
What did you call it? A meet cute?
Yeah, that's what it's called. A meet cute.
A meet cute.
Yeah.
So when you meet someone and you do something cute.
Yeah.
A meet cute,
like, you know, when you're meeting a prospective, you know, partner, potentially, it's what's called a meet cute.
Yeah. I've never heard that. Have you heard that?
You're learning things today.
A meet cute.
Did everybody else know that? No? This is great. I'm
Laura?
Teaching you all things today.
Yeah? Okay. That's why you don't know. A meet cute.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, you can take that one with you. You can use it in the rest of your interviews. Feel free to name drop me.
It'll be part of my common parlance now.
I love that. In reading interviews with you in prepping for this, there was one interview you said that you never stop learning. Every job you do, you take something away. What did this film and being on this film teach you? What did you learn about yourself?
I mean, Marisa Abella is one of the finest talents in this country. I mean, a bit of time has passed since then, so it was quite it was an experience just reflecting back on this era that I remember so well and so fondly. I think music from the period was great, just kind of reinforced that there was something special happening in North London at this particular time. Bands were awesome. You had indie music. I don't think you have that anymore. You know, and it did kind of frame this period in time in a way for me that, you know, might not necessarily have happened before.
If someone were going to play Jack O'Connell on screen one day,
yeah,
what are some of the details that you would really want them to get right, and what do you think might be tricky for them to get right?
Ooh, it's a tough one. I don't know, man. I mean, I think my accent.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be Derby. It can't be Nottingham. It can't be Yorkshire. It can't just be generic North. It has to be Elveston Derby.
Gotcha. I feel like you'll have very high standards when they come to meet with you, and you're grilling them about sort of their performance and what they're trying to do. You can stress this. You can tell them.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a nightmare gig for anyone.
I don't know. Someday, I wouldn't be mind seeing that sort of the Jack O'Connell story on screen. That could be fun.
Yeah, maybe.
He's very excited. Look at him. Before we wrap up, I wanted to quickly ask you about this little show that you were on called Skins. Dev Patel and Danny Kaluuya were also on it, and all three of you, I think it's fair to say you guys have done okay. Have you kept in touch with any of them, or what do you remember about filming that show all those years ago?
Oh, that was a great time, man. That was like a university for actors, you know, and partly because we were in Bristol, which is a massive student city as well.
Right.
Was on a TV job for like 2 years straight. So by the time we finished, I guess there was like a unofficial graduation. But yeah, it's all love. If we ever cross paths, it's all love. I think we've got that very unique thing that we all shared. And something gets forged from that. And
absolutely. I also read that you are potentially stepping behind the camera very soon, which is very exciting. You've worked with some of the greats, Michael Mann recently, of course, Angelina Jolie. Has there been anything that you've observed watching them that has stuck with you and that you're going to use when you step behind the camera?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. So that's been shot, that's been caught, that's going to be good to go in May. So that's a music video for one of Paul Weller's new tunes.
Oh, amazing.
It was a great opportunity, and I was very flattered to have been asked. I loved it, and I did feel like I had a wealth of experience from directors that I'd worked with that really came into play on the day-to-day. I'd never edited anything, though.
Okay.
I'm usually long gone by the time that process is taking place.
Yeah.
Editing's hard.
Post-production process.
Yeah, yeah, man. I'd never really... accounted for that before. Loved it though. Loved every minute. And cheers for asking about that, man.
No worries. Looking forward to seeing it. Jack O'Connell, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, mate.
So I unfortunately didn't see this because of train strikes and there being only one screening on the day of the train strikes. So I mean, there has been a lot of chatter about this before. You know, anyone's been able to see the movie. So it's kind of... Amon, can you set up kind of the basics of this biopic? Because it was done in collaboration or with the permission of the family. What's the situation there?
Sam Taylor-Johnson has gone on record multiple times now saying that she met with the family, but they had no decision-making power when it comes to the story that she was telling. So I gather that permission in a sense was given, but they had, according to Sam Taylor Johnson, no sort of say in how she was on her take on the story and how the story is being told.
Do you think, like, not to be like, do you believe that? But this is the difficult thing, I think, with any biopic that's done while there's still kind of either the living person or living relatives or people who are very close to the subject. I mean, we saw this with Bohemian Rhapsody, how much the sort of living members of Queen ended up shaping that narrative. Did you feel like this was an honest story about Amy Winehouse, or did you feel like maybe there were intruding influences? You know, even if it's not, you know, direct, there's still kind of a pressure, you know?
Yeah. It's hard to say whether or not there were, so that influence was there, obviously. Does it feel that way at times? Gotta say kind of yes, especially in regards to a couple of characters. You know, going into this film, you have the Amy Winehouse documentary by Asif Kapadia, which is lauded, in my opinion, rightfully so. It's very detailed and what it's trying to say, and the craft and how it's put together is exceptional. Asif Kapadia is well known for that. And so when you have that information to mind, and bear in mind, it's not even that long ago that that documentary was sort of made its way into cinemas. You go into this film and you're asking yourself, okay, I'm not sort of I'm coming to this open-minded, but I'm also asking, what new thing can you tell me about the Amy Winehouse story? What new insights are you giving me that I don't already know, that I haven't read about, that I haven't watched? And watching this film, I was trying to answer that question that was coming up empty, because of the way that the story was told. And I mentioned a couple of characters, and if you feel sort of dishonest to a certain extent, one of them would be Mitch, played by Eddie Marzan. And Eddie Marzan's a fantastic actor. I don't put this on him, but he comes across as very heroic.
And that's her dad, right?
And that's her dad, yes. And again, if you go into this film with the knowledge of the Yasser Kapadia documentary and all the articles and media that's been written about him, you may come away thinking, I don't know necessarily about what they're doing with that character. So yeah, this is a tough one for me in that regard.
Yeah, well, Hannah, I want to bring you in kind of with Amy herself, because obviously, yeah, we were all around for the media narrative that was constructed around her during her lifetime and also her death. And I think, like, it is really fucked up to look back and think about. I just remember how everyone talked about it with this horrible sense of inevitability. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, Hannah, like, I guess, like, how her death impacts the framing of the movie. Like, how is she portrayed as this, like, tragic, this was always going to happen? Or is there a little bit less focus on that?
You know, I didn't feel when I was watching this film that I was waiting for Amy to die. And I appreciated that. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say, you know, it doesn't go into her death. I mean, you don't need to see it in this. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to. Everyone knows how she died.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me, I guess the point, you know, everything you're saying, Lamont, but I guess that for me, what's the purpose of telling this story now?
Mm-hmm.
What do we want to learn? And I guess for me, going into this film, and I think in a way, it's kind of the focus on the relationship between Amy and Blake is not a misguided one, because so much of her music is about her romantic experience, her life.
Mm-hmm.
She says it, we know it. And I guess one of the benefits of, I guess, her lyrics and stuff is that she says it. There's no kind of mincing her words. She's so blunt in how she describes her feeling, you know, whether it's fuck me pumps, where it's like stronger than you, you know what I mean? These stronger than me, it's just all there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when you've got such potent lyrics like that, sometimes it's like, where's that coming from? And why, I guess for me as well, it's like this destructive nature of her. I think what they've done in this film in a way is kind of balance out a few things. You know, I think they wanted to kind of not totally like villainize Blake, Field of Civil.
Mm.
I mean, I will say, you know, we can only go on their words, that the family didn't have involvement in it. But, you know, we've just seen Bob Marley, One Love.
Mm-hmm.
Family are involved in that. Mm-hmm. This one, you know, it's very much a film that blames mostly the paparazzi on all of Amy's problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an oversimplification of everything. So I guess what I was really hoping for is this real kind of like deeper understanding of the girl, the woman. Why was she bulimic? Why does she have these destructive tendencies? Why was she depressed? Why does she have these codependent toxic relationships that kind of go into drugs? And the thing is, I feel like that's what it was tiptoeing around rather than really deeply exploring. So as much as I kind of didn't hate this, I didn't really, you know, it's been given a lot of hate, this film. Mm. I don't think that it's warranted that much. I do think the biggest issue with this film is the script.
I agree with that. And, you know, a lot of the stuff you're saying, completely agree with. I would have loved to have seen all the stuff you said. I would have settled, however, for, okay, this is a musical biopic. The title of this film is Back to Black. Let's take you into the creation of that album. Let's really dive deep into that. How does she come up with the lyrics? What musical decisions is she making here, there, and everywhere? Mark Ronson doesn't even appear in this film, and obviously Mark Ronson was a big part of that album.
What?
No, I'm saying
that's crazy.
Let's dive deep into that, and this film doesn't even really do that. Like, the closest we get is a scene early on where she's singing it in her bedroom. And it's, but it's not really, it doesn't feel like creativity because it feels already fully formed the way the scene is done.
I kind of disagree there because don't always think like, I know what you mean. Okay. I think there are some ways in which how things made, but like, do you remember in Bohemian Rhapsody where we had a scene like how they created We Will Rock You? It was like, guys, what if we do the clap thing? That's the most boring, generic thing. No one gives a shit about that. Like, no one cares. But it's kind of, it's more about, I don't mind maybe a scene like that, but I guess I've said this, and this is someone who's a musical fan, too much singing, too much music in lieu of actual kind of like character work that gets beyond underneath. Because again, the purpose of this film is to kind of explore who she is behind the kind of awful image we saw of her, you know, in the papers. And to be honest, like, when Asif Kapadia's film, whatever you want to say about who's painted as the villains in this kind of piece, like, it does really get under the skin of who Amy was. Mm-hmm. What I really wanted was really a little bit more of, like, the kind of, you know, there's so many moments where there's moments of stillness where you know, and Marissa Abella, she does, her performance gets better.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think it starts off a little bit rocky, but it actually really finds its rhythm. Sorry, pun. But like, it finds its rhythm, finds its groove later on. There's moments of real kind of beautiful. And then they throw a line in or something and it just kind of ruins it. It shatters it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, and it's really weird because I think, you know, what I loved about Nowhere Boy with Sam Taylor Johnson is that it was a really quite like restrained sort of piece. You know, this is, you know what, it really, I guess I feel like an Amy Winehouse biopic needs something like a Control, you know?
Ugh.
Like something that's really like pared back.
Yes.
You know, something that actually maybe doesn't even need any of the music in it at all, because actually, like, we know what the music is. We know it. We know her through that. It's the same thing I had my issue with Bob Marley. It was like, they relied so much on the music that the actual script didn't really reveal anything that the music's not telling me. So again, why do I need to watch this film to know who Bob Marley is when I can just listen to his albums? I think somewhat in this, there's just something in this where it's like, I know who Amy Winehouse is because the poet she wrote to music. So I guess I kind of feel like there's moments in this film that I think some scenes that are really powerful that really work for me. I'm just not sure. I guess I'm just not sure what they really wanted to say with this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Two things I want to say. One, I want to on record that it was Hannah Flint, not Amon Woman, who said too much singing just now. That's just underlined.
I said it. I know. I'm like, I'm the musical gal.
That's the first thing. Second thing is, you mentioned Marisa Abella. She is the best thing about this movie by a country mile. And, you know, this movie is almost worthwhile for her because I did not know about her before this film. But now I'm going to be like, okay, Marisa Abella, she's the one who played Amy. I'm interested to see what she does next because I think she does acquit herself very, very well here.
Yeah, I think there are some my only thing is, like, I think there's something about, she does a really good performance, but there's something about Amy
that is unreplicable.
It's just she has this attitude, this aura, mm-hmm. this kind of look where she's like, she's kind of reminds me of like Rachel Sennott, the way she looks, in that she's just so like there's something handsome and attractive about her, but not in a conventional beauty way.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just something. There's something there, and I think with Marissa, she was, and the part of them what was amazing about Amy is that she didn't look like the pop star girlies, and do you know what I mean? She didn't look, and she was really trying to fight the Spice Girls look. And I guess it's, you know, it's not Marissa's fault that she's a gorgeous gal, but I think that's also gorgeous. Part of it. And sorry, I was going to say, I think also she has the hardest job in this entire film. Because of that, because of Amy Winehouse being so singular, how do you do that performance without Pepe Kane? I don't know if the, like, I think she did amazingly well what she had.
Mm.
I think Jack O'Connell did an amazing job. And why it was so much easier for him in a way is because no one knows who Blake Field of Silver is. No one knows who he is.
Mm.
So he got to go in there and just do what he wanted. And, like, you know, anyone who saw him in Skins kind of loves this kind of Jack the Lad sort of character. And his, like, opening intro, as you mentioned, the kind of meet cute, that was honestly just like...
best in the movie.
Like, chef's kiss. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I think he's... I think he's just, I think he's a beautiful kind of beautiful actor. Mm. So yeah, so I guess I think it just really just comes down to, I think the script needed a bit of a rework in what it kind of really wanted to kind of say with what they had, rather than just do like a, again, it's conventional. It's like, this is what life, I mean, if you wanted to, you know, God hear me like saying how I would do it. But like, you know, you could do it where it's like, you're in this recording booth and you go back and forth, you know, sort of use that as a thought, like framing advice, but yeah.
Back to Black, directed by Hannah Flint. I want to see it.
I went there.
Well, I think unless anyone has anything else they want to shout out, I mean, Leslie Manville, she's the only name we haven't talked about on the thing. She's always good, though.
She was solid.
No Who's comment this? On Leslie Manville. Yeah.
Leslie Manville's like doing what she does. I do love the brown perm that she has. I do love that she's supposed to play Eddie Marsden's mum. Is that right?
What?
And I feel like there's like barely an age gap.
Oh, I assume she's mom. Amy's mom. Okay.
No, her mum's barely in it.
Oh. Right. Well, with that said, let's go to our screen stream or skip on Back to Black, Hannah.
I think we're going to go stream.
This is tricky for me. I'm in between the skip or stream. Well, you know, I'm in a positive mood today, so I'm going to say stream because, as I say, Marisa Abella in particular really surprised me in a good way. And yeah, for that reason, I'm going to say stream.
I can only just say, people listening, if you haven't seen Control, one of the most amazing musician biopics I've ever seen. The whole, it's so devastating and like, the anger of like what happened to Ian Curtis. Oh God, I saw it when I was a teenager and I was like just angry for the rest of my teenagehood about that. Incredible movie. Well, from not going back to rehab to not going back to United States. It's Civil War.
19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The future president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
Let me know if you want to try anything on.
Are you guys aware there's like a pretty huge civil war going on all across America?
We just try to stay out. With what we see on the news, seems like it's for the best.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death construction. Thank you very much. In a dystopian future America, a team of military embedded journalists races against time to reach Washington, D.C. before rebel factions descend upon the White House. This is directed by Alex Garland and it stars Kirsten Dunst, Kaylee Spaney, Wagner Moura, Stephen McKinley Henderson, and Nick Offerman as the president himself. Whew. So this is directed by Alex Garland, as we say. I'm personally a little bit up and down on him. Clarice, if memory serves, you're more of an Alex Garland fan than I am?
I'm an Annihilation fan. I love Annihilation so much. Mm. But that is partially because the novel by Jeff Vandermeer is just the truly most excellent novel. I think Alex Garland's, I think he's a great filmmaker. And I think Ex Machina was a beautiful looking movie and it really captured the tone. But then I really didn't enjoy Men at all because it was a whole movie that just felt like it was, Men. What are they like? They're pretty bad. It's a shame there's nothing we can do about it, though. Let's not talk about systemic issues. I just talk about how naughty those men are. They're so bad. Mm. And I will say this felt like the American politics version of that.
Yep. as you were saying that, I was like,
well, America's so divided. No. What's America like? God, if only there was like, I don't know, a structure, a system. I don't know. Maybe if it was like, oh, like white supremacy. No, that'd be silly. Let's not talk about that. Never mind.
Yeah, but before we get into that side of things, and believe me, we're going to delve
review.
Into it.
That's it.
You mentioned the filmmaking aspect of Alex Garland, and that's what I want to focus on for a second, because there's a lot of craft in this film that I really admire. You know, sometimes when I watch films, especially action films, I wonder and I ask myself, am I becoming too desensitized to violence? Because things will be happening on screen and I won't be too impacted by them. This film makes me think otherwise, because there are multiple points in this film where a gun goes off and it like had me jumping back in my seat. That happened like multiple times during this film. And just, you know, I think we all went the same screening. We watched it in IMAX, and there's a audio visual experience just on that level. I thought it was quite impressive. Hannah, would you agree with that?
Yes and no. I guess what's been interesting about watching this at this time where that I think some of the, I guess, the action set pieces were really well choreographed.
Mm-hmm.
I like the camera work. I like the kind of guerrilla feel of it. Mm-hmm. I like the kind of long shots, long takes that they did, the kind of whipping around the camera. You know, it did feel quite like, oh, we're in there.
Mm-hmm.
I have just at this point seen too many dead bodies in real life on screen that seeing this stuff here is a bit like in a film that says nothing feels a little bit kind of like empty to me. So, you know, there's a scene where we see like a mass grave and it looks horrible, but then I'm like, and I guess in if you take it out of context, but like, I don't know what these people have died for.
That's the big issue.
And I guess this is a thing. It's like, how am I supposed to engage with a piece of art that's kind of critiquing politics, polarization, critiquing kind of journalism, or like even trying to herald journalism as the kind of last vestige of like heroism in this world, when it has very little to contribute on the subject or even establish any sort of backstory stakes that could make me understand how this civil war even came to be?
Yeah. Now, the lack of context is definitely an issue with this film that only becomes more irritating the longer the film goes on. I remember there's a scene sort of quite late in the final act, so I'm not going to go into too much details, but it's outside the White House and there's a big old battle going on. There's gunfire everywhere. We're in it. We're following the journalists, but because we don't know who's on what side, because there's military on both sides, they're both dressed like military, I was just watching people shoot at each other, and it looked incredible, but I couldn't assign any emotions to any of it because of the lack of context. One of the things that I found a bit frustrating about this film, a big chunk of it is devoted to Kirsten Dunst's character. She's the war photojournalist veteran, and Kaylee Spaney is the newbie learning from her. And there's talk about taking good photos and what that means and what that constitutes. But by the end of the film, I wasn't too much clearer on what that meant in terms of taking, what's the difference between any old sort of war photo and one that really sort of, you know, speaks to what is going on and one that is quote unquote good. Did you get a better sense of that at the end of this film? Because that feels like something that's discussed, but also not really broken down and gotten to the minutiae of it all. Did you feel a different way about that?
Yeah, I found what it had to say, and I think a lot, you know, with all respect to people who liked this movie, I think a lot of the conversation has been, well, it's a movie about journalism.
Yeah.
But I still really struggled to see what is it saying about that, because there is a line of, you know, we don't ask, we record so other people ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really sure that stands up. And I think the movie itself proves that that doesn't stand up.
Mm.
I think a photograph in itself of just violence. This is what I hate about the movie. It decontextualizes violence. And I just think violence in itself without the story, that's not,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't move people. That doesn't tell the story. And so you have this idea that all a journalist needs to do is just like record. And it also, I think right now, it's a weird movie to have now when we're having real conversations about like, is journalistic impartiality actually possible? Because we are seeing that not hold up under many, many circumstances. And I think it's true of photojournalists as well, because it's not all impartial. There are micro decisions of what you choose to take a photograph of, how you release that photograph. This is the thing. We don't see what happens to the photographs after. That's such a key part of journalism, is where do the photographs go? What's the story being told? Obviously, someone's writing a story to go with it. What's that story being told? That's going to shape the narrative. And I feel like just stripping all that context away and all that really important shit that we should be talking about right now when it comes to journalism, which I think, you know, obviously this movie was made, you know, before, you know, everything going on with the genocide of Gaza, the journalistic concerns there. But we were having these conversations about Charlottesville, about the Trump presidency, about how that was being reported, about how the rise of fascism in America was being reported. Like, I just, you know, I understand what Alex Garland was trying to do, but I don't think this says anything that I don't think this is just contributing to the conversation in any way meaningfully when we really need to be having these conversations. I think that's what I found so frustrating about it.
I also think the idea of you know, I guess it's that kind of like very specific Reuters view of like objectivity and journalists, but I think if you're gonna have journalists as the heroes, you have to recognize they're also humans. Therefore, their work might have to be objective, but they have a position, right? What's the biggest thing about what, you know, we are journalists as well, news outlets and stuff. People move around, you know, people go from left wing to right wing papers and stuff like that. They might have to do a party line. People work for PA and stuff. They on, you know, in their work, maybe there's objectivity. BBC, there might be objectivity. I mean, clearly there's some subjectivity in some of the pieces we've seen, especially stuff that comes to Palestine about trans people. There's clearly a bias there. But I guess it's that thing. So I guess my issue with it, with the film as well, is just the way that I didn't know who any of these characters were beyond their beyond the tropey kind of like journalist, you know, you know, Wagner Moura is playing a kind of like adrenaline junkie journalist. He's just in it for the kicks. He's like, yeah, boy, going in. And it's kind of, you know, that's obviously a facade for something, but what's really kind of underneath there? There's a scene where, you know, it didn't ring true to me either. Like this kind of forced relationship between Lee and Jesse. You know, I don't mind like the stoic kind of like photojournalist, the weather worn, like she's seen it all. And all this type of thing. But there are certain scenes where there's a bit where they're talking about, they're I guess they're at a kind of refugee site and she can develop film. And then she's like, oh, you seem to know a lot about me. I said, well, I've read your Wikipedia page. What does it not tell me? And then it proceeds to not tell us anything about who Lee is. So a lot of the kind of decision making later on, and certainly in the final act, for me, I was like, why would someone, I didn't get the motivation there at all.
I really struggled with Jesse. I really, really did. Like, I get what they were going for, I think, which is that her ambition leads to recklessness, and they were trying to tie those two things together. And I think a better written character, that would have come through, and I would have had no issue with it. But for me, there's a line between ambitious recklessness and stupidity. And for me, Jesse was far too often on the stupidity side of things. I was talking about this with somebody else recently, and they made a really great comp. They compared Jesse to Kim Bauer in Seasons of 24, when she's really just making horror movie level dumbass decisions that get herself in trouble. There's too much of that with Jesse, and it really irritated me because she plays a big role in things going wrong all the way through the film, and at no point is she learning from any of it. And it just irritated the hell out of me. It really, really did.
And it's clearly trying to do that, some sort of hero's journey. It's a very picaresque story. You know, if you look at it, they're going on a quest, right? And they're going on a it's a road film, right? And so there's all these things they meet along the way. But it doesn't feel like we kind of learn anything or there's anything kind of newly developed that we find about the characters. The only thing that's developed is like the film role. And I guess it doesn't. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
I swear, the thing I quite annoyed me as well that she's called Lee Miller, because that's obviously after the actual, I think they referenced it in the movie, the real Lee Miller, who, what's interesting about her is I think, it was not photographed by her, but one of the most famous photographs attached to her is one of her in Hitler's bathtub. And this is after she'd been following like the liberation of Paris. And I think she'd like been to Dachau by that point and seen everything. And she goes to Hitler's apartment and she takes off her muddy boots, and you can see it in the photograph. She wipes it all over the carpet and you see the mud, and then she gets in the bath. And it's like, are you telling me that's, we don't report, we don't ask, we just take photographs? Like, it's,
yeah.
I feel like her, the person that she, this character's been named after, is such a great example of why that does not ring true. Like, that is such an, I would say go look it up. It's such an incredibly powerful photograph, because this woman has like seen the horrors that this man has inflicted on the world, and she has this moment of like, fuck you, I'm gonna drag mud all over your bath, your pristine bathtub. And I feel like that, like something like that would be a great story about photojournalism, instead of, I don't know what this woman, this Lee Miller's deal was.
I also just think there's this idea about, I guess, this detachment. And I just don't think journalists are detached. I think to be a journalist, to want to tell a story, you have to be attached in some sort of way. You have to have a motivation, whether it's for justice, whether it's to be truth seekers, you know, to really show the world and show injustice. I think that's the whole point of journalism. The point is to reveal what's going on beyond kind of power structures that basically want to tell us, lie to us, covertly operate, to hold the world to account. So I guess who is, I don't understand about this film, who are these journalists holding to account?
Well, we never see.
And again, it goes back to, we don't know where the picture's going. We don't really know who's commissioning them. And so for me, again, I think, you know, I said earlier, it's just like, how am I supposed to engage? Or I feel like I've so detached from this film because it's not trying to like attach any sort of kind of humanity to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fully agree. Before we move on, Zenda, want to say anything about the performances? Because as frustrating as other elements of the film are, I do think they were pretty good. Kirsten Dunst brings a sort of hauntedness and a stoicism to that character that, even though we never sort of get fully the details of what the history is, we can surmise some of this nonsense that she's gone through and she's put up with. I thought that came through. Stephen McKinley Henderson, always love seeing him on screen. He brought a lot of wry humour to the role. And, you know, any bit of levity you take in a film as dark as this, you know, is very helpful. And he brought a lot of that. So for me, those two were the standouts. Did anybody stand out key performance-wise?
I thought Kaylee Spaney was great. And I saw where she got the Priscilla role, because there's that same... Yeah, I do agree. The character's quite simplistic and, you know, it's a pretty standard character arc. But I think, like, she kind of made me believe it. And it was still that same sense of awakening that you see happen in Priscilla. I would say Priscilla's the better performance. Mm. But I was like, okay, cool. I'm excited to see what you do in Alien Romulus now.
Yeah. Good trailer.
I really enjoy Kirsten Dunst in brittle mode, like, fuck you mode. I think I really, like, she can... She's just got this very withering stare, withering look to her. And I actually really like it when she's kind of like, just keep away from me. Like, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Because also, I think it goes, I don't know what you're speaking about, I really love what she said as well, just about like how she's aging and stuff. Like, I want to take these roles. And like, you know, it makes sense. She looked like, and it's not to say, but I guess... she looked real, like a human being. She looked like a real person who'd been like, and obviously there's things that obviously add to it, makeup and stuff. I'm not saying that she looks like a weather-worn wall journalist, but there is something about when you see a woman's face and you can see that they haven't been, someone hasn't tried to turn the clock back. So actually they look like someone who's, you know, who doesn't give a shit about those kind of things, who when he's looking at a dress, doesn't really want to wear it, right? Mm. It's hard to convince you of that character if the person, the actress in real life, has had Botox, so she's got no lines. So to convince me that this woman of a certain, you know, those little things work. And I'd also have to say shout out to her husband as well.
Yeah, that was the best scene in the movie.
I guess, like, he's very good at playing, he's also very good at playing mean people. I was also he wears these red sunglasses in it, and I constantly think about these red pair of sunglasses that I am with red lens in. I was like thinking, God, I bet you can see anything, because you can't really see anything in red shades.
Yeah, not for nothing, but one of my favorite recent quotes in anything is Kirsten Dunst on Jonathan Glazer's speech, which she said, what I took from it is that he was saying genocide is bad. Print that. Great stuff. Anyway.
I liked Wagner Moura as well. I even really, because he's from Narcos, right?
I haven't seen. Yeah.
But I saw him, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the new show. He pops up an episode of that. And he's great in that show. He's very charismatic.
Yeah.
I would like to see more of this man. Show him to me.
Make it so. Okay, let's go to our screen stream or skip recommendations. On Alex Garland's Civil War. Clarice.
Yeah, it's going to be Skip. What's my alternative? Read Annihilation, the book. It's pretty short.
Hannah Flint.
I'm going to say Skip. Watch the news.
Okay. I'm also going to say Skip. If you're going to watch a movie with Civil War in the title, Captain America Civil War is right there. And it's very, very good. Very, very good.
Or just a documentary about the Civil War. Any of the Civil Wars. Educate yourself.
Or watch Captain America throw his shield. I mean, is that really a choice?
Famous historical event.
From a country divided to a classroom divided, it's time for the Teacher's Lounge.
Guten Tag. Hat aber nichts mit Magie zu tun, sondern mit Mathematik.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher! Teacher! Leave them kids alone! Is that how it goes? I think I said teacher.
It is now.
No, that's how it, that's the official. I've rewritten it. Carla Nowak is a dedicated and idealistic new high school teacher. A fresh face at the school, she seems to have connected with her year 8 students who are engaged and eager to learn in her maths class. But something is bubbling underneath the surface, and she's quickly thrust into a delicate situation when a Turkish boy is suspected of theft. Not convinced of his guilt, Carla takes matters into her own hands and inadvertently starts down a path that soon begins to spiral out of control. As she tries to mediate between students, parents, and opinionated colleagues, she is relentlessly confronted with the structures of the school system. Carla is pushed to her limits, and the school becomes a proxy for the cultural and ethical clashes of modern-day society. Directed by Ilka Shatta, from a screenplay by Shatta and Johannes Dunker, it stars Leonie Bench, Leonard Stepnich, Eva Lobau, Michael Klammer, Raphael Stachowiak, and Sarah Bauret. So I haven't seen this film this week, but it seems like a very kind of powder keg of a film. Starts slow but builds to a kind of crescendo. Mark, can you just tell me a little bit about, I guess, like, the pacing, the tone, the kind of, like, atmosphere of this film?
Yeah, I think it's paced really, really well, and you nailed it. It starts off quite slow, and then it builds and builds up as we get more into Carla's headspace and the decisions that she makes throughout. You know, it's so interesting with Carla. She's the polar opposite to what I was just saying about Jesse and Civil War in terms of what the characters are doing and the decisions that they're making and how we feel about them. When Jesse is making bad decisions in Civil War, it just irritated me because it just felt silly given how the film was written and given how I was made to feel about that character sort of throughout the film. Here, the decisions that Carla makes, some of them are not good, but you can understand why she's making them. You don't hate her at any point for making them. And at least for me, even though some of the decisions she makes, again, are not very good, I still felt that she was an innately good person at her core. And that was in part what was driving some of what we see. And I loved that for the film. And the pacing is great. Like, this film has been compared to Uncut Gems in various reviews that I've seen because of the powder keg that you mentioned and because of the stressfulness of the situation. I wouldn't quite go Uncut Gems that far because that film, you know, watching that film, I was like screaming at the screen because of just the madness of what was happening. And this doesn't get into that level, but it does still feel very stressful. And the paranoia especially ratchets up at a really sort of effective pace all the way through. So,
Clarice, did you think it was effective?
Yeah, it didn't remind me of Uncut Gems. It reminded me more of like The Crucible. Right, because it feels like you take this kind of this very tightly knit society of the schoolroom, and you never leave the school, which I think is really interesting. Yeah, it's like the teacher's lounge, and then you see a couple of classrooms and hallways, but you never really actually. Well, you do for one scene briefly, but you know it's basically self-contained within the school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have that sort of like rolling effect of you have this one accusation and mm-hmm. then maybe she's done something a little bit shady to get that accusation out there and to get the proof of the theft and what's been done. And then you just have that kind of spiraling further and further and further and further out of control, which is, I guess, like sort of like what happens in The Crucible. It's like, you know, one little accusation destroys mm-hmm. the whole town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you can take that and you can, you know, use it if you want to talk about, you know, society and da-da-da society. I think, you know, obviously it's not as powerful a metaphor as The Crucible. Because, like, in the end I was like, I feel like this movie is just about, like, you know, snitches get stitches. mind your beeswax, lady.
There's a few things the teachers do in this. I'm like, what? Like, what are you doing? That's really weird.
To yourself, yeah. You little snooper.
Yeah. But like,
I think that sparks interesting conversations because I think the question of the movie is, you know, if you see someone doing some like a crime or something shifty, do you intervene knowing that the powers that will intervene are maybe, you know, not the best and the people you want in your life?
But it felt uncomfortably relatable at various points, in part because of what you're saying and what you're alluding to.
Are you a snitch? Are you a rat?
No. That's not what I'm saying here. Don't try and twist my words.
To the cops?
Oh my gosh. But in a sense that you see something and you have a reaction to that thing, but that reaction spawns a worse reaction and that reaction spawns a worse reaction and it just spirals out of control. I have been in the vicinity of that sort of storm of events, you know, at various points. And that was the uncomfortable relatability that I was referring to, Clarice, to clarify.
I think the Ben Mendelsohn voice was like, was it, you ain't been talking to the cops now, have you?
Is that Animal Kingdom?
Yeah, but it's that podcast where people were doing it when he was doing oh, you ain't been talking to Darth Vader. It's such a good, I obviously can't do it, but someone does a really good Ben Mendelsohn impression somewhere on the internet.
I guess then we can talk a little bit about the performances. I assume it's got quite an obviously the main person, Carla. Then we have the young boy, child actors. Was she a strong enough lead? What, did it feel more like a one or two performances or an ensemble kind of success story?
Nah, much of this is on Leonie Benesch, and she is fantastic. Again, we really get into Carla's headspace. There's scenes where she doesn't know where her kids are and she's teaching their class as she's trying to figure that out, and all the fear of what it could possibly mean is playing out on her face. And, you know, the stress levels and the paranoia that I was talking about, a lot of that is through her performance, because this film is very much through her point of view. So yes, there are scenes where they are in the teacher's lounge and there's, you know, arguments that break out amongst them that are sort of very well performed, and the child performances feel authentic and don't take you out of the film. I'm not sure how often they've acted before this film. I haven't sort of done that research, but they were very solid. But for me, this is Leonie Benesch's film, and she's fantastic.
My favorite child actors were the one in like the school newspaper, because there's this incredible scene where the newspaper kids take her for an interview, and then all just start grilling her. Mm-hmm. And it's a full blown interrogation. And there's sort of the little cute younger kids that are in her class, and there's two older girls who like start, they just like come in the room like good cop, bad cop. And that whole scene is so well done, incredibly tense, but funny because they're just kids and she's so scared by them.
Amazing. Yeah. Was there anything else that kind of stood out for you? The score, anything that really added to this?
The score by Marvin Miller is really, really good. For most of the film, it's not really a factor. The film was very content to just have the camera be on Leonie Benesch's character and watch her sort of go through the halls and go about the film's business. But when it does come to the fore, it really makes an impact. There's one scene in which Carla is having a panic attack after an incident, and the strings really pack a punch. They're very unnerving and really help accentuate that particular scene. So that scene, especially the score, stood out to me. Marvin Miller. Didn't know about the composer before this, but I'll be following his work with great interest. That was a Star Wars reference, just in case you didn't know.
Well, it's just the sincerity of it, the seriousness. It's like, I'll be following his work with great interest. It's like, it felt very like Radio 4. Clarice, anything to end on?
Oh God, now I'm panicking. I don't know.
Oh, you don't have to. We can just move on.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, that is our review. Let's go for our screen, stream, or skip verdict for The Teacher's Lounge. Clarice?
Yeah, I would say screen.
Come on.
I would also say screen. This is my film of the week.
I think I really want to go see this now. I might go see it in a cinema. Okay, great. I love it. It's like, I do have a link. But I feel like I want to see it. I just realised, like, there's so many films. I've got such a privilege of having a Picture House card. And I should just use it instead of just watching it at home. I can just go in. So I'm going to make the most. But I'm like, oh, wait, maybe I should wait. Maybe the person that I'm going on a movie date with will want to go see it. So who knows?
Oh, very true.
There we go. Okay, well, it's the end of the reviews section. Time for our...
Hot take. Where's it going now? Where are we going?
You're going with this.
I was like, waiting for someone to go somewhere with it. That's
jumped
into something, and I was like, oh, we're going to do that this week.
Sorry, I used all my musical prowess for the Fallout special. I was singing a tune in that one.
We were singing tunes.
Okay, all right. I'll let you guys off. Okay, when Francesca Amawuda Rivers, the star of Jamie Lloyd's West End production of Romeo and Juliet, was faced with a barrage of racial abuse following her casting announcement, almost 900 black artists and fellow performers published an open letter in The Guardian to demonstrate solidarity with her. The Jamie Lloyd Company also issued a public statement to social media on April 5th, I think it was prior to this open letter being published, condemning the barrage of deplorable racial abuse online directed towards a member of our company. But as actress Selena Jones pointed out on Instagram, which was then reposted by Queen Charlotte star Arsema Thomas, where is Francesca's co-star Tom Holland in all of this? And so I guess we really want to know, where is he? Hello? John Travolta looking around. Vincent Vega looking around the apartment.
It's a good gift.
I think we can say like that. Stars like Tom Holland be sticking up for their co-stars and speaking out and showing public solidarity when their co-star has been a victim of abuse in any form online. Clarice, you brought up something earlier.
This wasn't me that I saw people were bringing it up online. I think because I follow a lot of Star Wars fans, but they were sharing the video that Ewan McGregor posted when Moses Ingram was getting the same shit for the Kenobi show. And, you know, the video is really simple. It's just him saying, hey, I'm really proud of the show. It's great that it's done so well. But, you know, as a star and executive producer, you know, you are not a Star Wars fan if you're participating in this behavior. And he said, you know, and then says, I love Moses Ingram. We're really proud of her. We stand by her. So I think that's what is frustrating in situations like this, is that it can be so simple. Like, I don't, I'm not the boss of Tom Holland. But all he would need to do is just a short video saying, hey, I stand by my co-star, you know, in solidarity with her. This is not okay. Even just a piece of text, a tweet, something to just say the very simple statement of this is not okay. And, you know, especially I can say kind of like within the Star Wars space, it happens a lot where people would like use white stars as a way to attack like co-stars of color or co-stars who are women, and I think that was when it was really crucial to sort of go, no, you cannot use me as a weapon. I'm not okay with this behavior. This is my co-star, this is my friend, this is an incredibly talented person, I stand by them. So yeah, I think that it's just like, you know, and what is like controversial about posting that? What are they risking? Oh no, yeah. your racist fans might not like you anymore. It's quite concerning if a star is like so convinced that the majority of their fan base are racist. Like, maybe you should rethink your career if that's what you're worried about, losing their support.
Yeah, I certainly, for me, I'm confused considering his girlfriend is black, so it just seems a bit of an odd thing. It's not like the easiest thing. I mean, my very short answer to this is always defend your co-star or anyone who is the victim of abuse if you are not only higher in the power structure, but if you benefit from the power structure. Aman?
Yeah, co-sign everything that's been said. You know, I know that Tom Holland has had an experience with social media that hasn't been great, and he has chosen smartly to step away from doing that regularly, and I respect that. But by not saying anything, he has invited more attention onto this issue. And so I'm not saying that him saying something is going to sort of stop this entire thing and nip it in the bud, and people are going to just, you know, stop doing what they're doing, because unfortunately this train is never late, and it's going to probably unfortunately continue to happen anytime there's a similar issue. But his words would have had an impact if he chose to say something. And there's still time for him to do that, but now that there's so much attention on him not doing that, it would almost feel like he couldn't just do a simple statement anymore. It would have to be more than just a simple tweet, more than just like a 15, 20 second video. It would have to be more something more substantial, because now there's so much more attention on Tom Holland hasn't said anything. Why? And I get that the people who would be sort of thinking or having, I get that the people who see this and people who are partaking in this don't matter in the grand scheme of things in terms of the nonsense which they're spewing. But the conclusions that they might be thinking based on Tom Holland's inaction, they're going to put all that nonsense online as well. And again, it's going to make it a bigger thing than it needs to be in certain respects. So there's still time, as I say, for him to come out and say something, and I hope he does, because in this instance, his words would have impact, and this is something that you come out of your social media absence for to do. So
yeah.
You know, I will say, just as a benefit of the doubt on this, just to be like, I don't know what's going on with Tom Holland or whatever. There could be some extenuating circumstances why he hasn't posted. I honestly hope there is. Because, you know, at this kind of thing where you're like, you know, certainly in the case, sorry to be always bring it back to Palestine, but there are people who haven't posted, the people haven't said stuff, and there could be many number of reasons why people haven't done support and all that type of thing. I guess my thing is, and I respect, and we can't possibly know what's going on, but, you know, you did the red carpet literally this week with your girlfriend for challenges. You're not ill. So I really hope there's an excuse or there's something coming, and maybe he's just trying to get his words right, because, yeah. And that's the problem. We often fill in the gaps and things like this, but it's just odd because it's something so simple. And if you're worried, like, this should, you know, what backlash could you possibly get for defending your castmate?
I guess the thing with whenever we do these hot takes, it's like, it's not just about Tom Holland, and you're right, we don't know, but this is a thing that happens frequently enough that there is clearly a pattern, and you know, it seems like he's guilty of it. Maybe we don't know there's an instance, but, and also I find the, like,
it's so dumb it's just a dumb it's a dumb thing. She is literally not the first person black woman to play Juliet. I think, you know, it's colorism as well, wrapped up in this dark-skinned black woman doing it, you know.
And I find that the, oh, they're not on social media, or they don't use social media excuse also doesn't stand for me, because, like, he has the account. And if even if he didn't have, Ewan McGregor doesn't have social media, but he still put a video out. Like, they have assistants, they have people. They have friends and family with social media accounts that they can put the message through.
Yeah.
Like, it's, and because I, again, you know, this comes up a lot with Palestine. People go, oh, well, they're not active on social media. And it's like, okay, they can find a way.
Tessa Thompson had not used her Twitter account.
I was literally going to mention
2022. And she literally dusted off her, found a password, did forgot password, found the app password, got back in, and tweeted about Cinema for Gaza.
Yeah. Like, it's not hard if you care about something. And I think that's just the thing. It's like, you see, I think the Ewan McGregor one is a really great example, because it was so, like, you know, the first episode dropped, he put the video out saying, no, stopping this now. And I think, to me, you know, I was very impressed by that. And I was like, okay, cool. This is an actor who cares about his co-stars. Like,
and I will say, that was also an actor who understood the history of Star Wars actors being attacked and not having the support, racially abused and not having the support of places, Disney, of their co-stars and stuff when it comes to that, really, if you think about it. They didn't really have people speaking out when Kelly Marie Tran was experiencing that stuff. So I think it was really just showed of someone who, like, I don't want to be part of that problem anymore.
Yeah.
I'm setting a new standard, a new precedent. And so that's why, Ewan McGregor, you left your wife, but you stuck up for Moses. So, complicated people. People are complicated.
I don't even know what to say.
And on that, the hottest take.
I really like Hugh McGregor, and I heard a lot of good stories about him being very caring about co-stars on Birds of Prey as well. So I feel like, I don't know his life, but from what I've heard, he seems like he cares about his co-stars, and that matters to me.
I was actually lucky enough to spend about 15 minutes or so with Ewan McGregor virtually.
I'm best friends with Ewan McGregor. We go biking on the weekends.
E to the M, what up? No, but yeah.
Wait, well, you can fill us in on that off mic. Let's say our farewells. Thank you for tuning in and happy viewing via whatever medium is safest for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It makes a difference. And tweet us any questions or hot takes at FadeToBlackPod on Twitter. I'm at Hannah and S. Flint on Instagram and Letterboxd.
I'm at Amon Warman on Twitter and Instagram.
And I'm at Clarice Lowe on Twitter and at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
Farewell there. It's time to fade to black.